From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Kevin Phillips started his political career in the late 60s as a Republican strategist, but now he fears the GOP has been transformed into the first religious party in U.S. history. On today's Fresh Air, Phillips talks about his new book, American Theocracy. Also, we talk with Peter Dinklage. In the new film, Find Me Guilty, he plays the lead defense attorney in the trial of the Lucchese crime family. It's a refreshing role for him. It doesn't center on the fact that he's a dwarf. Dinklage starred in the film The Station Agent and had a very funny scene in Elf. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the new memoir, Falling Through the Earth. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Kevin Phillips, has written a new book that was the subject of a question put to President Bush by a member of the audience yesterday when he spoke to the City Club of Cleveland.
My question is that author and former Nixon administration official Kevin Phillips, in his latest book, American Theocracy, discusses what has been called radical Christianity and its growing involvement into government and politics. He makes the point that members of your administration have reached out to prophetic Christians who see the war in Iraq and the rise of terrorism as signs of the apocalypse. Do you believe this, that the war in Iraq and the rise of terrorism are signs of the apocalypse? And if not, why not?
The answer is, I haven't really thought of it that way. Here's how I think of it. First, I've heard of that, by the way. I guess I'm more of a practical fella.
As you heard in that question, Kevin Phillips' new book, American Theocracy, elaborates on his concerns about radical religion and politics. He fears that the Republican Party has been transformed into the first religious party in the U.S. But it's not just religion he writes about in American Theocracy. He warns about the dangers of our growing debt and dependence on oil. His previous book, American Dynasty, was about the Bush family's impact on American politics and policy. Phillips is very critical of the Republican Party, but he started his career helping to get Richard Nixon elected in 1968 and serving in his administration. Phillips' first book, The Emerging Republican Majority, which was published in 1969, was described in Newsweek as the political Bible of the Nixon era. I spoke to Phillips yesterday before the president addressed the City Club of Cleveland. Kevin Phillips, welcome to Fresh Air. Your book is subtitled The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century. Do you see radical religion, oil, and borrowed money as being interconnected in any way?
Very much, and much more after I finished the book than when I began it. To begin with the question of radical religion and oil, what you found in the whole lead-up to the invasion of Iraq, for example, is that George W. Bush, with his constituency of true believers, was responding in part to their whole sense of an end times and Armageddon context in the Middle East. And as a result, they interpreted what was going on there through a biblical lens, as opposed to an oil sensitivity lens that might have been the case, say, in the upper echelons of Exxon in Houston. And the upshot was that you couldn't talk about oil as a reason for invading Iraq because so much of the constituency had a religious reason for watching all of this, but yet the two are very much connected. If you think in terms of the questions of debt and oil, for example, again, very, very much connected because the more that we go into hock to foreigners in order to pay for the imported oil, which is a very major portion of what we import, the worse the whole crisis gets, because the bigger the debt, the greater the strain on the dollar. And if the dollar starts to fade again, that just raises the price of oil. So all of these things come together, and it is the triangle that Washington does not want to discuss.
Why do you think Washington doesn't want to discuss it?
Too many bedrock issues and concerns and things for which there is no obvious solution. To admit that debt has many, many consequences in terms of what we have to do to get oil, where we may have to invade, to admit that in Iraq we're not there for democracy, we're not there for all the pretense. There may be trumpets of democracy, but it's drums of gasoline. All of this just raises too many issues about the fundamental mess the United States has gotten itself in, really for 15 or 20 years, with the collaboration of presidents of both parties. George W. Bush wasn't the only one talking about weapons of mass destruction.
But you do say that the Bush family has helped tie together finance, national security, oil, and the religious right. Would you talk a little bit about the role you think the Bush family has played in connecting those things?
part of the reason why the Bush family is such a problem for us at this point, and for the Republican Party, is that with the exception of the election of 1996, there has been a Bush on the Republican ticket running for president or vice president in every election since 1980. They have really put a firm fingerprint on the Republican Party. And the three things that they've been involved in doing that are so important to what's happened. The first is that because of George H.W. Bush's difficulties with a religious right, he developed the art of pandering to these people to a pretty elevated degree. His son got into politics in the national vein in 1987, 1980.
Right. Okay, I don't know what limited recordings means. So maybe you should just say no recordings.
No recordings.
Maybe that. But the website's okay, right?
Everything else is absolutely fine. Okay. Absolutely.
So why don't we write on that, everything okay, but except recordings of the interview. So I'm going to assume like transcripts of just the spoken words is fine. Yeah,
fine.
Okay, that's good, that's fine. Sorry to introduce that complication, but it's can make me do it.
I understand these days.
Yeah. Okay, good. So I always do the introduction live, even though the interview is pre-recorded.
The time we got to the 2000 election with George W. Bush, he was not only himself an oilman, although a very unsuccessful one, but he had a vice presidential running mate who was also out of the oil business, Dick Cheney. So the extent to which the Bush family and the 25 years in which they've had a major imprint on the Republican Party has emphasized pandering to the radical right, the religious right, the role and importance of oil and connections to finance help explain a lot of what has happened. And the fact that these are central crises for the United States at this point is not unrelated to the prominence of the Bushes.
You write about what you describe as the oil national security complex when you're writing about the role that you think oil has played in foreign policy. How influential was oil when you worked for the Nixon administration in the late 60s?
Well, it was enormously important in the 1960s, partly because you could see some clouds on the horizon, but even more because within the Republican Party, the great goal of realigning politics in the Republicans' favor rested in no small part on Texas. Texas was a very important state, and it was the great oil state. And Richard Nixon really wanted to take Texas, and that was one of the reasons why he was very interested in promoting the career of George Bush Sr., who was the first major Republican from Texas, and that was part of a long-term Nixon strategy to sort of Texify the Republican Party a bit.
And you're right that the new battle regarding oil was defined in 1973 when Secretary of State Kissinger and others in the cabinet promoted, just short of openly, a plan for using U.S. airborne forces to seize oil fields of Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Abu Dhabi. What was the plan?
Well, the plan that was discussed pretty covertly with the British was basically to take over those oil fields, just use American power bluntly and openly. You can say in retrospect that maybe it would have worked, but we went instead under Carter towards a politics of trying to conserve energy and reduce oil dependence, and that also worked. I think it was a better option. But there is a larger context which is important to mention, and that's that really for 100 years now, the military focus on the Middle East has been oil-related. The emerging oil fields of Saudi Arabia, of Iraq, of Iran have been targets. They were targets in World War I. They were targets in World War II. They've been targets ever since. The notion that a war is fought in that part of the world and it is not related to oil is a joke.
So if you think that oil is really the motivating force behind the war in Iraq, what about the neoconservatives who made the argument that the war in Iraq would democratize Iraq and a democracy in Iraq would inspire other countries to become democratic and it would change the whole face of that region? Oil was not their argument. Democracy was their argument. And so how do you think that compares in the Bush administration's motivation for war with the oil argument.
Well, back when George W.'s father invaded the Persian Gulf to expel the Iraqis from Kuwait, he and James Baker, then the Secretary of State, were up front. They said it was about energy, and you couldn't have Saddam Hussein controlling all the oil resources of the Gulf. Now, nobody was saying we have to bring democracy to Baghdad. But because of the sort of odd quirks of the second Bush administration, first, the extent to which they had all the biblical interpretation people in the Republican coalition, and then secondly, the neoconservatives, who at least pretended to be more concerned about democracy, but frankly, I don't think that was what they were concerned about. I think they were concerned about the geopolitics of the Middle East, and democracy was just icing on a geopolitical cake.
My guest is Kevin Phillips. His new book is called American Theocracy. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Kevin Phillips, and his new book is called American Theocracy, The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century. You write that the last two presidential elections mark the transformation of the GOP into the first religious party in U.S. history. Now, I mean, no one would argue that the Republican Party has strong support from the religious right, but in what way do you see the Republican Party as a religious party?
Well, let me start with a little bit further back chronology. Back after the 1988 elections, a political scientist in Ohio by the name of John Green, who's subsequently become quite well known for putting together religion and politics, suggested that because of the role of religion in 1988, with Pat Robertson running for president and bringing more of the Pentecostals and Southern fundamentalists into the Republican Party, that you were really beginning to centralize religious people of all persuasions in the United States in the Republican Party. By the time we got to 2000 and 2004, this was much more clear than it had been back then, partly because Bill Clinton, although a Southern Baptist, became anathema to the church-going Baptist and many others in the South. And then in 2001, the whole role of religion came to the fore after 9/11 because George Bush was structuring a fight between good and evil. So the upshot was that by 2000 and 2004, you were looking at a very, very strong correlation between religiosity of people, more than church attendance, but that was a fair part of it, or religious services attendance. And you wound up for the first time ever, I can't think of any precedent in American history, where the religious Protestants, the religious Catholics, and the Orthodox Jews were all on the same side and strongly conservative and strongly Republican. The only exception is that among religious blacks, they weren't Republican, but they were more Republican than the other blacks and were motivated very much by some of the church-related issues, including gay marriage.
Your book is called American Theocracy, which will imply that you see our government now as being a religious government where religion, the rules of religion apply to the country. I mean, why use such a strong word?
Well, I use a strong word because I think in a country like this, as big as this and as diverse as the United States, we've got about as much right now as you can have in the direction of theocracy, and it's a major problem. But let me give you a quick summary of why I think there really is a major theocratic element here. First off, we have this high correlation now between church attendance and voting Republican. We have the Republicans in several cases openly caught trying to organize the churches and get lists of congregational members and communicants and what have you. We have a Republican rank and file. I have two pages of charts in the book that shows the theocratic inclinations of the Republican electorate. For example, should religious leaders try to influence politicians' positions on the issues? The country as a whole says no by 2-1, but white conservative evangelicals say yes by 62-37%. Another yardstick, which is very significant, is you've got a president who in the course of years since 1999 and 2000 has often been quoted by people as saying he thinks God chose him to lead the country. Now, you can say he believes this, but he's even said, been quoted in Middle East papers, although the White House denies it, that God told him to invade Afghanistan and told him to invade Iraq. You have a Republican rank and file, approximately 50-55% of whom believe in Armageddon, and the Antichrist is alive now. You have Republican state conventions, one recently, the Texas State Convention in 2004, that passed one of these platforms calling the United States a Christian nation and getting into all the things about how religion and government have to become closer and the sort of government agencies that, that they would abandon. You've just got all these different yardsticks. This is a major transformation of an American political party.
My guest is Kevin Phillips. His new book is called American Theocracy, The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century. Let's talk about the third leg of your argument here, which is borrowed money. Now, in your book, when talking about debt, you describe the credit card, mortgage, auto loan, corporate debt, federal borrowing, industrial complex, which you describe in short as a reckless credit-feeding financial complex. Now, there's been a lot of focus lately on the national debt, but you're talking here in part about personal debt. So how does personal debt figure into the larger picture that you're writing about, you know, in terms of America's predicament?
Let me take this question of debt and a debt-related industry and the growth of that industry and put it in a quick context. In the 1960s and 70s, by far and away the largest portion of the American economy, single portion, was manufacturing. Its share of GDP was, in the mid-20s, and finance was pretty small. But as debt grew, both public and private, in the United States in the 70s and 80s and 90s. Slowly but surely, the industry of handling debt and managing money has raised its share of the gross domestic product, so it is now far ahead of manufacturing. Now, manufacturing gave a lot of lower, middle, and blue-collar people in the United States middle-class status. They got to have fishing cabins in northern Michigan. They got to have good jobs. Well, that's all moving offshore as we do the money thing now. But the money thing is inherently so favorable to the upper brackets, to the people who have capital and who basically just move money around and have it aggrandized, that it erodes the work ethic of the country, and you get the money ethic rises to the fore. And we have so much debt now, and we're so willing to borrow money overseas, that at some point, the people from whom we borrowed, be they Asian central banks or people in the Middle East with oil money, they're going to call it. And at that point, the dollar weakens enormously. And for a lot of Americans, that just means instead of marginal middle class status that's no longer marginal middle class, it's out of the middle class.
In your book, you warn that U.S. global supremacy could drain away more in 5 to 20 years than most Americans would have thought possible. Exactly what are you warning about?
That's a triple warning. I'll try to give a very, very short version of the triple play. Essentially, the United States, by trying to reach too far as part of a global hubris and a sense of destiny and democracy and everything like that, is at great risk of what historians call overstretch, of trying to bite off more than it can finance and more than it can afford and without an intelligent blueprint for doing so. And lack of an intelligent blueprint is a wonderful one-sentence description of Bush policy in the Middle East. Nothing they blueprinted has worked out. Debt is mounting. As debt mounts, the dollar tends to weaken as the dollar weakens, the cost of oil goes up. As we are preoccupied with finance and debt, we make less and less. So we have to buy more of the things that machinery and consumer goods overseas, and then that just puts us further in debt. This is an enormous mess. The extent to which we have a government that has no sense of proportion or history is a huge problem. But I would underscore again that while the principal burden is on the Republicans, the Democrats are so inept in understanding these same things that they don't know what to criticize. Either that or they're basically funded by a lot of the same industries anyway.
As we've mentioned, you started your career as a Republican strategist with the Nixon administration. How do you define yourself politically now? Republican, Democrat, none of the above?
Well, I'm an independent, and I really do like the idea of none of the above. I think if we could ever have none of the above on the ballot, it'd elect two-thirds of Congress. But some of my politics is still somewhat conservative. I don't relate to the across-the-board liberalism. And I don't think of myself as being liberal when I critique the Republican Party. I would say you've got a mix of radical religion. You've got radical oil dependence, which isn't sufficiently acknowledged or recognized. And you've got a radical extension of debt. So maybe I'm the conservative, and maybe they're the wild-eyed people, and they're conspiring to keep their incompetence from being noticed. But, you know, it is being noticed.
Kevin Phillips, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Kevin Phillips is the author of the new book, American Theocracy. You can find an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Next week, I'll speak with Fred Barnes, whose new book, Rebel in Chief, praises President Bush. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Walmart, working with its customers throughout the month of March to help America second harvest in the fight against hunger here at home. At secondharvest.org. From the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Most of the roles Peter Dinklage gets focus on the fact that he's a dwarf, but not his role as a defense attorney in the new film Find Me Guilty. Coming up, we talk with him about his movies, including his starring role in The Station Agent. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the new memoir Falling Through the Earth. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Peter Dinklage, is best known for his starring role in the independent film The Station Agent. He played a man who feels shut out by others because he's a dwarf. Dinklage is 4.5 feet tall. He had a very funny scene in the Will Ferrell movie Elf. His new film, Find Me Guilty, is a departure from roles that focus on his size. He plays the lead defense attorney, Ben Clandis, in the trial of the Lucchese crime family. Against his recommendation, one of the 20 defendants, played by Vin Diesel, insists on representing himself. The movie is based on transcripts from the Lucchese trial, which lasted 21 months between 1987 and 88. Here's Dinklage making his opening statements to the jury.
I have the fate of Carlo Mascarpone in my hands. There he is, sitting near his brother Gino. They didn't join the Lucchese family because they already had one. The family created by Mr. and Mrs. Mascarpone. It's called biology. You'll hear a lot about my client's flamboyant lifestyle. His wife, Rosalind, sits in this courtroom, married 17 years, 4 children. That's a lifestyle. He goes to St. Lucie's Church. His wife teaches CCD. That's a lifestyle. Many of these defendants are related, some are friends or neighbors that have known each other since playing Little League baseball together. That's a lifestyle. They are a family. Not the kind of family the government talks about. They would twist it. They would make it evil. But all we're asking for, ladies and gentlemen, is to let justice be done, though the heavens may fall. Thank you.
I asked Peter Dinklage how he prepared for his role in Find Me Guilty.
A couple years ago, I had served on a jury for a murder case, actually, and we found the kid not guilty, and I kind of loosely based my defense attorney on this defense attorney that this young man had, court-appointed attorney, and he was so good, and he was so persuasive, and almost like an actor. There's not much difference, I think, besides their knowledge of the law between an actor and a lawyer when it comes to presenting their case in front of a jury. They can become showmen. And sometimes playing a lawyer, you feel like you're overacting. But that's kind of what they do. And remembering this guy really helped me. And so that was sort of the research I had done.
Now, how'd you get the part in the film?
Sidney Lumet had seen a movie I did called The Station Agent. And he really liked that film and the job I did with that. So he was kind enough to offer me the role, which I didn't even read the script when he offered it to me. And I said yes, because it's Sidney Lumet. You don't really turn down Sidney Lumet if you're an actor. He's the greatest actor's director. He understands actors, and you rehearse for a couple weeks before the cameras roll, and he makes you feel very well prepared as an actor.
The only reference in the movie that I can think of to your height is at one point while addressing the jury, you stand on a little box to
right.
to lift you up a little bit. Was the role written specifically for you
for somebody my size?
Yeah.
No,
mm-hmm.
no, not at all. That was Sydney's idea. Which, but I love about the film is it doesn't address it. You know, I mean, it does and it doesn't, which is so true to life. And I think with the thing with the, that was Sidney's idea to wheel out this podium. But like I was saying before about the sort of the drama of it all, and to sort of, I think that was Sidney's intention to sort of have this almost. It gave Clandis a little bit more power in a way, and a little bit more persuasiveness, and maybe even a little sympathy, which you utilize all of that. Lawyers utilize everything at their disposal to gain the sympathy of the jury, especially in a criminal case like this.
Was it refreshing for you to get a role that wasn't built around your size?
Always. I mean, I mean, I don't want to be in denial about roles that are written for my size and everything, because that's important, too. I mean, a good role is all about the writing and who's there to direct you and guide you through it. Obviously, a movie like The Station Agent dealt with it, but it didn't hit you over the head with it. It's only part of who a character is, just like it's a part of who I am as a person, but it's not everything. And I think the fault of a lot of writing is with scripts I've read that I don't end up doing is it's the entire character. Everything, every other line is referring to the size, or everybody's referring around, the other characters are always referring to the size of the person. And that's just, not good writing. That just doesn't happen, you know. It's once in a while something will come up and on a day-to-day basis, but that's the more realistic version of what life as a short-statured person is.
Well, in The Station Agent, which you starred in, you played a man who inherits an abandoned station agent house on an abandoned railroad line, and you decide to move into it. And you're so lonely and withdrawn, largely because of your size in the film, that it makes you feel different from everyone else. And after you've removed yourself to this, like, isolated, abandoned place, you end up making actually really close friends from nearby who have their own issues that have left them feeling lonely.
Right.
And disaffected.
Tom McCarthy wrote the script. That's sort of his. He illustrated that so well, so subtly. And we had a great time making that movie.
Now, you say that you don't like the kind of role where every line is about your height, you know. Mm-hmm. I want to play a line, like, it's a couple of lines, from The Station Agent. And I'd like to play this, like, short scene and then tell me what you like or don't like about the scene and what made you, you know, comfortable about doing it. I should say that your character in this, in the outside world, is always, people are always just saying exactly the wrong thing and mocking him. Kids call him sneezy, and people meet him and they go, "Deplane, Deplane." Mm-hmm. And then this is one of the friends that he's made. This is like the hot dog guy who runs the stand right outside of your home. And he's talking to you about really personal stuff. So here's that little clip.
Okay.
Can I ask you a personal question?
Sure.
You've had sex, right?
Yes.
With a regular-sized chick?
Yeah. With a regular-sized chick.
You ever had it with someone your own size?
No.
Do you wanna?
I don't want to talk about this, Joe.
Why?
I just don't.
Peter Dinklage, what works about that scene for you, and did anything about it make you uncomfortable?
Well, yeah, what I loved, and especially what Bobby Cannavale did, what he brought to it, it was almost like aggressive, his questioning, and I just love how Bobby plays that scene. It really helped me, like, get uncomfortable, actually. No, not just the way it was written, but how Bobby sort of forced these answers out of me, his character. And, you know, that's something that, I mean, Tom and I had a lot of long talks about, you know, stuff related to my size and the day-to-day issues, and he used that in the script, and it was really interesting working that way.
Is this the kind of question people actually ask you? inappropriate people who shouldn't be asked, people who don't know you well enough to ask anything so presumptuous.
Right. Well, what I find, that scene is, it should be a little uncomfortable, but it's also really important. I think it really brings those two characters closer together, because it's sort of, it's an honesty that Bobby's character had, Joe has, that he's very forthright and doesn't see anything really wrong about asking me those questions, as a lot of people who are very politically correct or something would. And it's, the question is, what's worse, being sort of forthright and not seeing anything wrong about asking questions like that, or being sort of politically correct and very reserved? And I think being very reserved about stuff in life in general, not even stuff with people's differences, can be damaging, being too reserved. I mean, like, when I'm walking down the street and a child points at me and questions who I am, and a mother or father tells them to look the other way, I don't find that to be healthy at all. I because those people are going to grow up to be sort of people who look away, you know, and that's just, you know, there comes a point where it's let somebody be curious, and if they're, if it comes, you know, when it's coming from the right place. And I think with a character like Joe, and with stuff I've dealt with friends in my own personal life, honesty is and some forth, being forthright can be really healthy for a relationship.
My guest is Peter Dinklage. He co-stars in the new film Find Me Guilty. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. ¶¶ My guest is Peter Dinklage. He co-stars in the new film Find Me Guilty. He's best known for his starring role in The Station Agent as a dwarf who's lonely and alienated. I want to play another scene, and this is a kind of famous scene from the Will Ferrell comedy Elf. And again, this is another scene that's about your size. Mm-hmm. And this is it's a scene at a kind of business meeting. You're an author. You're at the publishing house, and there's a bunch of people sitting around the table. One of them is Will Ferrell's father. In the middle mm-hmm. of the meeting, Will Ferrell
James,
walks in.
James Caan.
Yes. And in the middle of the meeting, Will Ferrell walks in, sees you sitting at the table, and assumes you're an elf.
Right.
I didn't know you had elves working here.
Oh, boy, you're hilarious, my friend.
He doesn't. Get back to the story, please.
So, on the cover above the title.
Does Santa know that you left the workshop?
You know, we're all laughing our heads off.
Did you have to borrow a reindeer to get down here?
Buddy, go back to the basement.
Hey, Jackweed, I get more action in a week than you've had your entire life. I've got houses in L.A., Paris, and Vail.
Oh.
Each one of them with a 70-inch plasma screen. So I suggest you wipe that stupid smile off your face before I come over there and smack it off. You feeling strong, my friend? Call me Elf one more time.
He's an angry elf.
And that's a little scuffle as you beat up Will Ferrell.
Yeah, unfortunately, I have to beat up Will Ferrell.
I mean, that's a funny scene, and it's a scene, and you have a couple of scenes like this in movies mm-hmm. where you play the dwarf who's really annoyed at all the stereotypes and really annoyed at how people see him, and you're really funny about it.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I like that stuff because it kind of turns it on its head. I love comedy, and I really do have a sense of humor about myself, or I try to, at least on good days. And obviously with that, a sense of humor about my size. And movies like Elf and Living in Oblivion do as well. And if it's like that, then I really have no issue with it at all. I find it to be fun to be a part of. And I love turning things on their head and flipping them around like that, which is what these movies do. And Will Ferrell, I think, is a comic genius. So,
well, you mentioned Living in Oblivion, and that's an independent film that mm-hmm. Steve Buscemi starred in as a director.
Right, a film within a film. Yeah,
yeah, and there's a great scene.
That was
scene.
Actually the first. I got really lucky. That was my first film that I was ever in. And
oh, really?
I was actually spoiled. I thought they would all be as good as that, and they aren't. But you're lucky to be a part of something like that.
should we play your scene from this film?
Sure, if you want.
Okay, so this is Living in Oblivion.
God, and going down memory lane.
Memory lane. And Steve Buscemi plays an independent film director, not a very good mm-hmm. one. And mm-hmm. this is like his big dream, surreal dream sequence. And Catherine
right.
Keener is the actress in the sequence.
Right.
And then there's like lots of smoke. And then,
yeah.
And then you walk in.
And a powder blue tuxedo I'm wearing.
Yes, you walk in a powder blue tuxedo. Mm-hmm. And
bad prom date.
Yeah, and you really hate the scene, and you let Steve Buscemi know it, and here's
right.
what he has to say.
Right.
Look, Tito, it's not that big of a deal. It's a dream. Strange things happen in a dream. All I want you to do is laugh. Why is that such a problem for you?
Why does it have to be a dwarf?
What?
Why does my character have to be a dwarf?
It doesn't have to be a dwarf.
Then why is he? Is that the only way you can make this a dream? Put a dwarf in it?
No, Tito.
Have you ever had a dream with a dwarf in it? Do you know anyone who's had a dream with a dwarf in it? No! I don't even have dreams with dwarves in them. The only place I've seen dwarves in dreams is in stupid movies like this. Oh, make it weird. Put a dwarf in it. Everyone will go, whoa, whoa, whoa. There, it must be a f-ing dream. There's a f-ing dwarf in it. Well, I'm sick of it. You can take this dream sequence and shove it up your
That's
angry.
That's
God,
Steve Buscemi and my guest Peter Dinklage in a scene from Living in Oblivion. That's a very funny scene. And I'm wondering.
Well,
go ahead.
Oh, sorry. No, go ahead, please.
No, you.
I hadn't heard that in a very long time. But there's also this weird thing like about anger. Angry dwarves. People always think like dwarves are very angry people, and I also just like that about that scene because I'm actually angry. yeah, it's another stereotype, I guess. Although, you know, sometimes I get mad.
Whenever I hear that scene, I think of Twin Peaks.
Yeah, I mean, God, that's what I was afraid of because I love David Lynch so much. And the stuff Michael Anderson did in Twin Peaks, the backward talking and the dancing. But yeah, you can't help but make a comparison between those two. I you know, it's more just frustration about if you need an image to be weird, put somebody in it like a dwarf or something.
Your first film was Living in Oblivion, which we heard a scene mm-hmm. from. So mm-hmm. What was the audition like for your role? Because, you know, you played a dwarf who's cast in this surreal dream scene. Mm-hmm. So what was the casting call like for that?
I read for Tom DiCillo, the
Did
the
he know you
director.
Already?
No. Actually, the funny story is when I was working in an office job at the time, and he called me, Tom DiCillo did personally, to invite me to come and read, and I thought it was, he called me at this office. I was in a cubicle, miserable, working a temp job, and I answered the phone, and he introduced himself, and I laughed, and I was like, yeah, come on, man, don't bother me at work, and I hung up on him, thinking it was a friend of mine, because, you know, friends would, we have a tendency to you know, mess with each other's heads, and as soon as I hung up on him, I kind of froze, my hand was frozen to the phone, and was thinking that didn't really sound like anybody I know. But thank God he called back and I apologized to him. And I got the role, so it worked out well.
Lucky he called back.
It's not really a funny story, Terry. I'm sorry.
It could have been a tragic story.
It could have been a tragic story. Jeez. Based on that one, I could have probably still been in that cubicle today.
So did that movie change your life?
Mm-mm. No, not... I don't believe in big breaks. I think it's a myth. I mean, there's roles that you do that really affect a lot of people and lead to other work. But I did that movie and then I went back to working part-time jobs and you know I didn't get another movie after that movie for about 8 months and that was a brief role in some straight-to-video movie and it was tough going for many years. I wasn't able to really pay the rent as a working actor until I was about 30. So no, all through my 20s, and I made that movie probably when I was about 25. So for about 5 years there, I had to, after Living in Oblivion, I struggled along and, you know, working odd jobs and doing plays with friends downtown and occasionally appearing in some movie, but, you know, having one couple scenes in an indie film, you know, doesn't break the bank.
So now we heard a couple of scenes in which you play a dwarf who's really angry and sarcastic about the way somebody sees him.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever in real life been that angry and sarcastic person in response to somebody saying something really stupid to you?
Yes. I mean, we all have our bad days where our patience is not even, doesn't even exist. Yeah, you catch me on a bad day, and I mean, it was different when I was younger. You know, as a teenager, I was pretty, you know, surly, wearing a lot of black and you know, hating the world and all of that it stands for. And it's sort of heightened a little bit if you're, you know, 4.5 feet tall, that sort of anger. But, yeah, I mean, I still will have bad days where if somebody does a laugh or a point, and I just confront them and sort of just say to them, really, does that really make you a better person or something doing that? You know, I try not to, because that's just going to put me in a worse state of mind, and it's not your issue, it's theirs, and I just try to have a sense of humor about who I am, and the older you get, like anybody, you just sort of let that stuff roll off your back.
Well, now, like, say you're at the airport and somebody's staring at you, it's probably because mm-hmm. you're in movies, not because of your height.
That's the rationale I use now. They're not looking at me because I'm 4.5 feet tall. They're looking at me because I'm a famous, famous movie star. No. Yeah. You know, I don't know.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Peter Dinklage plays the lead defense attorney in the new film Find Me Guilty, directed by Sidney Lumet. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews a new memoir by Danielle Trussoni about her attempt to better understand how her father's life was changed fighting in the tunnels of Vietnam. This is Fresh Air. Danielle Trussoni's just-published memoir is called Falling Through the Earth, and in it she explores the damaging legacy of her father's service in Vietnam. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says the memoir is also an unusual testament to the father-daughter bond.
Daughters and their fathers' wars. Now there's a subject that hasn't been strip-mined yet in literature. For my generation, the wars were World War II and Korea. As a kid, I remember standing out on the sidewalks of Queens, New York, and having shouting matches with the other neighborhood girls about which was the best, the Army, the Navy, or the Air Force. All of our fathers had served in the armed forces, and we were fiercely proud little female partisans on their behalf. Their wars bestowed a larger-than-life luster on our dads, most of whom otherwise were just working stiffs. For Danielle Trussoni, the war she inherited was Vietnam, which partly explains why, in her striking new memoir, Falling Through the Earth, her evident pride in her father's service is also shot through with anger and bewilderment. The other complicating factor here is that her dad, Dan Trussoni, seems to have been trouble even before the Vietnam War further messed up his life. As Trussoni points out, it takes that kind of man, two parts stubborn, one part insane, to fight in a tunnel. Serving in Vietnam in 1968, Trussoni's father volunteered to be a tunnel rat, one of those soldiers who crawled underground through a network of tunnels and rooms searching for the Viet Cong. The tunnels were often booby-trapped with explosives, urine-soaked punji sticks, or scorpions rigged into bamboo cages. It was virtually a suicide assignment. But Dan Trussoni, unlike a close buddy of his whose gruesome death he witnessed, made it out by the skin of his teeth. Back home in Wisconsin, he married three times, fathered a bunch of kids, some of whom he cruelly refused to acknowledge, and escaped into drinking binges, fights, and obsessive overtime construction work. Vietnam was always present, burdening the emotional atmosphere of the Trussoni home, sometimes even making its presence felt tangibly. When she was a girl, Danielle Trussoni found a human skull and trophy photos of dead Vietnamese soldiers hidden in the basement of her family's house. Falling Through the Earth is Danielle Trussoni's messy but compelling wrestling match with her father and the legacy of his war. I say messy in the sense of not perfect, because Trussoni sometimes overwrites, like when she describes Vietnam as an amorphous monster that would grab hold and pull us into it, kicking and screaming. It came to live in our house, eat dinner at our table, sleep in our beds. Trussoni is much more winning as a writer when she sidesteps melodrama and sticks to the gruff understatement and rueful humor that surely must be the tone she inherited from her tough love father. Writing, for instance, about a bar called Roscoe's that became a second home to her and her father, Trussoni comments, "At Roscoe's, if you hadn't had the short end of the stick most of your life, if you hadn't been screwed over in some form or another, there was surely something wrong with you." Trussoni's memoir splits into three alternating stories. There's the recreation of her father's wartime experiences in Vietnam alongside her own recollections of growing up, which include her parents' divorce and the division of the family. Danielle Trussoni, at age 10, chose to live with her father, for whom she was named, and to become, as she says, his accomplice, while her siblings stayed with her mother. And interspersed with these two narratives, there's also Trussoni's hypnotic account of traveling to Vietnam as a 24-year-old woman, trying to find the source of her father's rages and depression. Trussoni even goes so far as to take a tour down into one of the old Viet Cong tunnel systems, squinting through the dark, desperate to figure out what propelled her then-young father deep into this claustrophobe's nightmare. Crawling down into the earth, excavating deep into her own memories, Trussoni is intent on a reconnaissance mission as foolhardy and admirable in its way as any that her tunnel rat father ever pulled off.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Falling Through the Earth by Danielle Trussoni. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shorrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Count of Monte Cristo, introduced by Luke Sant, available in stores and online. From United Artists and Sony Pictures Classics, presenting Capote, starring Philip Seymour Hoffman, available on DVD March 21st. And from Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. Information at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Tim Flannery about his new book, The Weathermakers, how man is changing the climate and what it means for life on Earth. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.